I'm Lee Hay, and starting off the show tonight is a song, Shiny Stockings, featuring Kenny Poole on guitar along with drummer Philip Paul, who is the guest of honor this evening on this special edition of The Blues. King Records is in the spotlight this month in Cincinnati, and session drummer Philip Paul was an essential element in the recording mix at King. So tonight you'll hear an interview recorded August 5th with music historian Larry Nager, Country Music Hall of Fame senior historian John Rumble, and curator Michael Gray. These three folks are on the phone from an office in the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, and Philip Paul's in our studio. They're exploring Mr. Paul's musical career on the blues.
This is Larry Nager. We're here to talk to Philip Paul, King Records house drummer, through the kind of the golden age of King Records. And I'm down in Nashville through the miracle of technology at the Country Music Hall of Fame with John Rumble, one of the senior historians here and the man who did the highly influential and well-regarded interview with Henry Glover, and also Michael Gray, who is the producer of the Grammy-winning Night Train to Nashville exploration of early rhythm and blues and soul music in Nashville, Tennessee. We're all very excited. The man of the hour is Philip Paul. Hi, Phil.
How you doing, Larry?
Very good. Happy birthday. Hey, this will be September, so 90 years old, still gigging. That's a wonderful thing.
Very fortunate.
So we want to talk to you about, you know, kind of go over your background. You started out playing calypso music back in New York.
Right.
With your dad.
Yes.
Tell us about how you got started.
Well, my parents were from the Caribbean. And, of course, the calypso was the main music we played, and my father was a trumpet player, and I started playing gigs with him, and he would play house parties. Started at 11 and go till 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, and he broke me in that way. I played many house parties. He helped me carry my drums, and he showed me what to play. I learned a lot of beats, and I guess that's what makes me different from a lot of drummers today. I had firsthand knowledge of how calypso's supposed to be played and sound.
And a very complicated, that Afro-Caribbean rhythms to it. It's not simple playing.
No, it isn't.
And you went from that into kind of, there was a great bebop scene, the great jazz scene in New York, just as you were coming up as a kid.
Yeah, in fact, I was right in the middle of that movement. Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Max Roach, they were all trying to put that music together. And it was not only exciting and informative, it was kind of dangerous because at that time the drug problem came up and we had a lot of our famous musicians getting involved. I guess they thought they had to do that to be more creative. But out of that came some great music, as we all know.
Unfortunately, you avoided that pitfall.
Oh, yes. There. Oh, my father was to kill me.
It's always a good thing. Now, your big kind of entry into music as far as what ended you up in Cincinnati was when you joined the band of Buddy and Ella Johnson. How did you join that group?
Around New York, I was good friends with the Prysock brothers, and Arthur sang with Buddy Johnson also. They were instrumental in recommending me to Buddy Johnson to be their drummer. And Buddy Johnson used to travel on the road. He used to come to Cincinnati at that time, too, you know. So he wasn't a stranger to Cincinnati. Anyway, I joined the band and played a lot of gigs, played the Savoy a lot, because the Savoy usually employed a big band and then had a small band, which was Tiny Bradshaw at that time. And Tiny Bradshaw came over to me one night on a break and asked me if I would like to join his band. And he called me several months later, and I came down to Cincinnati on the Greyhound bus, and that there began my career with King Records.
Now, we should say the music that you were playing kind of had a jazz element to it, but it was sort of what we call now jump blues. It was more dance music, driving beats, and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And who'd you replace in the Tiny Bradshaw band?
That was
Eagle Eye, right?
Eagle Eye Shields, yeah. He's been gone quite a few years now. He came down to Cincinnati to see me because he knew he was sick and wouldn't be with us long. And he came down to the Cincinnati Inn Hotel to see me and to say his own personal goodbye. Yeah.
And may he rest in peace. He just passed away not too many years ago. It was a few years. And he also did sessions at King as well. So how did you come to King Records? Tell us that story.
Well, unbeknownst to me, Tiny Bradshaw had a plan. He wanted to change the sound of the band, you know, with Eagle Eye. It was kind of loud, blasting, backbeat all the time, and he wanted to mellow the band out because Tiny Bradshaw had some good musicians with him. One time he had Sonny Stitt with him and Sil Austin, another saxophone player. He had a trombone player. He had trumpet players, Bill Hardman, that played with Charlie Mingus. He had Sam Jones, a bass player, that played with Oscar Peterson. So it was an all-star band. And he wanted to just bring the volume down and allow the quality of these musicians to shine. He said to me one day, he said, we're going to the studio. That's after we had been in the Cotton Club, played the Cotton Club for about 3 or 4 weeks. And he said, I think we're ready to go in the studio. So that was a surprise to me because I had no idea at that time that Tiny was under contract to King Records. But we went in the studio and we did a tune by the name of Soft. And I had to play brushes on that, which was different for a swinging band, you know, usually use sticks. Mm-hmm. And that became a hit. We traveled all over the country. And for the next 3 or 4 albums, I had to play brushes. But that was my legacy to the Tiny Bradshaw Band.
Also, it seems like it's more fitting for a recording studio where you don't want, like, being a great club musician is one thing, but it's completely different to be a studio player.
Oh, yes.
Where you need that subtlety, that sense of dynamics.
That's right. But for some reason or other, I was able to handle that because I played a lot of brushes around New York, and you still had to drive the band, but like you say, you have to have the physical dexterity and just the know-how, how to pinpoint certain things in the music to make it propel.
But it's a great thing to sort of be responsible for the hit record. I'm sure that didn't escape the notice of Sid Nathan, that there was money in those brushes.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's why I had the next 3 or 4 albums, I had to play brushes all the way through. Irregardless of what tune we were playing, he wanted brushes.
Now, you were also working at that time at King Records. It was a fairly integrated business at a time when that was unheard of, certainly outside the doors down there on Brewster Avenue, but really throughout the music business in general. So the A&R man was Henry Glover, right?
Right.
You worked with him. When did you meet Henry?
As soon as I came to King Records, my first recording with Tiny Bradshaw, I met Glover, and a talented man, and he was able to explain to the musicians what he wanted, and as a result, he always did a successful recording.
This is John Rumble. Yes, pleasure to speak with you, sir. What did Henry tell you, if anything, about his background? Why was he so able to communicate with the musicians?
Well, he was a musician himself. He was a trumpet player. I think he played with Lucky Millinder. And in fact, I saw him at the Savoy. Lucky Millinder played the Savoy quite a bit with his big band. And Glover was a trumpet player with him for some time. And he just knew how to handle musicians. He educated musician. He knew what the tune needed when we recorded it. He could write a chart for any one of the musicians. And in general, he could tell you what he wanted and get it.
Well, he'd been to Alabama A&M and gotten a lot of music instruction there. He had good teachers in high school, he told me,
right
back in Little Rock.
He wasn't the type of musician that he could front a quartet or anything like that, but he was a good section man, and he could front a recording session. He could
handle there must be something session. About trumpet players, though. You know, it's like Willie Mitchell at High Records was a trumpet player, and, of course, W.C. Handy was a trumpet player. There's something right. executive quality about trumpet players. Now, Sid, on the other hand, would tell you what he wanted, but he had no idea what he was talking about, right?
No.
That was the contrast between the two men. Sid actually would tell you how to play the drums.
There's a big story there. Well, Sid would often, he didn't know what he wanted, but he sat in the booth and he could feel, after being in the booth so long, he could feel what he wanted, but that he'd come down out of the booth sometime and tell us musicians what we should play. And he did that to me on the Twist. We had recorded all day, and I guess I was playing the same beat over and over again, which you tend to do if you're recording all day. And he came down out of the studio, and he grabbed the drumsticks out of my hand, and which was a cardinal sin, because you don't do that to a musician, especially in front of other musicians. And he grabbed the drumsticks and he said, "I want you to do this." And all he did was shake the drumsticks in the air. And he said, "I want you to do that." So I got angry, and without thinking, I snatched the drumsticks out of his hand. I said, "Don't do that, Mr. Nathan, please. Don't take my equipment and do that." So he looked at me and he walked around and went back up in the booth. And he said, "All right, let's try it again." And we started the tune over again, which was a Twist. I played the very same beat that I had played before. And he said, "That's it. That's it." So you see what Sid was trying to do was get in your head. You know what I mean? He was like a storefront psychologist. See, he would threaten you and can just talk and try to frighten you and get some kind of a feeling out of you, you know, make you angry, anything to make you change what you were doing before. But I fooled him that time. I played the same thing.
Come on, baby. Let's do the twist. Come on, baby. Let's do the twist. Take me by my little hand and go.
And we should mention the fact that this is the very first version of The Twist. This is the version by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters that would later be covered by Chubby Checker and became the hit record. Very controversial, just why all that went down. We still don't exactly know what happened with that, although Dick Clark, who owned Cameo Parkway, was a power in business, obviously. But Sid, as far as cover records go, Sid was kind of the king of the cover records.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the unique setup of King Records. In case anyone listening doesn't know, King was all under one roof.
Right.
It had the offices, it had the studios, it had the mastering, it had pressing plants, it had printing facilities. You could go in like in the afternoon and come out the next morning with a finished 45 or 78 that could go in the jukeboxes, that could go out to the distributors. That was a process that Sid turned into an art form, essentially. Do you remember doing like specific cover sessions that they would teach you guys a song very quickly and turn it around? Do you remember any particular cover sessions you did?
We did Fever.
But you did the original Fever, right?
Yeah,
that's Little Willie John. That was an original, though. That wasn't covering somebody else's hit.
We did quite a few. I remember covering a lot of country songs that Sid would have me come in.
Was it Delbert Barker that was the big cover guy? He was one of the people.
Yeah, he would have me come in and he'd play a tape, and I'd wear headphones. And maybe I'm a little ahead of you, but I'll go ahead with this story anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had a tape of some country music. Of course, back then, you did not have drums on a country tune. So
right.
Sid got the idea, let's add drums to these tapes, and I can maybe reissue these tunes. And that's what he did. I would sit in the studio, and he'd play the tapes, and I'd wear the headphones, and I'd come up with a beat to fit a country tune. And I did that for months, because Sid had a backlog of country music.
And he was always messing around with the sound. He felt that folk music, they needed more guitars and less on the bluegrass stuff, less mandolin, less banjo, that sort of thing. The success, I guess, of the Delmore Brothers gave him the guitar sound, but also just when folk music started coming in. But now you also played drums on the Stanley Brothers' Finger Poppin' Time, another idea of Sid's,
right,
to make it for the kids, I guess.
I think Hank Ballard and Midnighters did that also.
Yeah, that was their song. So the Stanleys covered it, I'm sure, at Sid's suggestion. And in fact, they say that Hank Ballard was doing the finger pops with the Stanleys in that session.
I wouldn't be surprised.
The thing about King is you had James Brown and the Stanley Brothers working in the same building.
Right.
Which is hard to get one's head around, I think. It's such a different musical atmosphere. And that was the atmosphere that you basically spent your entire working life for a decade or more.
More than a decade.
So you also worked with Freddie King a lot on those. What was a Freddie King session?
Oh, he was one of the most enjoyable musicians that I've ever recorded with, because Freddie King knew what he wanted, and evidently when he came into the studio, he had played the tune that he had in mind to record many times for a crowd on the road. And he'd come in and he'd stand in the corner and be playing this tune that he wanted to record. At that time, we didn't know that. But it would sound so good that maybe Freddie Jordan, our guitar player, would start playing, and the bass player would start playing, and then I'd join in. And before you knew it, we had the whole rhythm section playing with Freddie King. And he said, "That's what I want. Let's record it." And that's the way we made Hideaway.
Now, when you did Hideaway, and after you'd cut that, was there a sense of, we really have something here? I mean, this is good. Or was it just like, okay, and that's another good track, let's move on?
No, it was so good, but Sid being the kind of person that he said, let's do two or three more, just in case. But that first one was good enough to chip out of there, and it was just remarkable. And most of the tunes that we recorded with Freddie King were like that. Because he was well prepared. He knew what he wanted, and when he came into the studio, he was ready to record.
Can you take us through, like, what your average work day at King might be when you get into the building, what you would do, set up the drums, how many sessions you might do a day, whether you were doing, like, Freddie King session, and then you might do a Cowboy Copa session, you know, turn to country music, that sort of thing. Take us through a day at King, if you could.
Well, to begin with, lots of times I would be at home. In fact, I live maybe four or five blocks away from the studio. I still live there.
And that was the house that Sid had found for you, right?
Right, because when I first came to Cincinnati, I lived down in the West End, and Sid wanted me to be closer to the studio. So he told me, he did not ask me. He said, I want you to move closer to the studio so you can be available whenever I call you. So I said, fine, yes, sir. And he finally found me a place, and I knew the realtor, and we moved right in Evanston. And Sid would call me maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes he'd call me himself and say, "I want you over here. He wouldn't tell me who was going to record. He said, "I just want you over here. I want you over here by 8 o'clock. At that time, I didn't have a car, so it was in walking distance, which was great. But I'd stay at the recording studio all day, and we'd have lunch there and dinner. And sometimes we go past 12 o'clock at night, because Sid would say, "I don't care how many mistakes you make, we're going to get this done so we can ship this tomorrow." So we would stay in the studio all day. If maybe we just did one album, we would stay in the studio all day till it was completed, till he was satisfied. Sometimes we would do maybe two or three sessions at one time.
With different artists, in other words.
Right.
The idea of it getting out so quickly, is that because there were artists who might try to, or other labels that might try to steal a project? Before we got on the microphones, John was talking about what happened with Owen Bradley and Paul Cohen and Blues Stay Away From Me. Do you want to speak to that, John? John Rumble.
Well, Henry Glover told me that he had recorded with the Delmore Brothers and Wayne Rainey, Blues Stay Away From Me, to which Henry had written the melody, and Alton Delmore was the main person who wrote the lyric. Sid had the acetate in his briefcase, and he went to a musical convention, probably the Music Operators Convention. Paul Cohen of Decca stole the acetate out of Sid's briefcase. And somehow he either copied it or had somebody play it and memorize it, but he slipped right back down to Nashville, recorded it, Owen Bradley, and mostly the same musicians who had recorded it for King Records. So when Sid found out about this, he barges in the studio. He's got smoke coming out of his ears. And, "You know, you bunch of traitors, you bunch of thieves." And somebody said, "Well, wait a minute. We didn't mean to do that. We just played what the producer told us to play." And somebody else said, "Well, listen, Sid, don't be hollering and screaming. I wasn't even on the session." And Sid says, "Well, all I can say is when you get hit in the butt by a buzzsaw, you can't leave out one tooth. You gotta blame the whole damn blade."
That was Sid.
That was Sid.
Stay away from me. Blues, why don't you let me be? Don't know. You keep on haunting me. Love.
on the country sessions, were you were the only black musician? Was it a white session band in the studio, or was it the artist's band by the time you
no,
were?
No, I recall being the only black musician. Maybe sometimes we would have Freddie Jordan, our guitarist. He was the session guitarist for King Records, excellent guitar player. Sometimes we would have a string section from UC Conservatory, but most of the times I was it.
Yeah,
it was like something new, you know.
And were there country session players then from the Midwestern Hayride? Or
Oh, yes. Yeah. I did some recordings with Bonnie Lou and and the rest of the cast over there.
But, I mean, in the band, in the backup band, who were the musicians that might be playing in the on the country sessions, if you could remember?
It was mostly the band that played for the Midwestern Hayrides.
Well, early on, Henry told me in the very late 40s and early 50s, Louis Innes was there, Tommy Jackson, Jerry Bird, Zeke Turner. They had essentially backed up Red Foley at WSM in Nashville. But when the Midwestern Hayride went network, they all, as a group, just migrated up to Cincinnati because the pay was so much better. And then when the Hayride started cutting back, they came back to Nashville.
Well, sir, I started recording for King in 1951. So that was a little before my time, but I've certainly heard of these musicians, but I don't know of them. I never recorded with some of them.
You worked in 1951, then, as far as that goes, with the Jump Blues artists. You were working with people like Wynonie Harris.
Right.
And the people
right.
who essentially formed the foundations of what would be rock and roll. I know there's a big exhibit about to open here at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and all you WVXU listeners are invited. It's the Sam Phillips exhibit. And so much of the music that came out on King was very influential to that first generation of Memphis rockabillies recording for Sam at Sun Studios, and as well as like the Rock and Roll Trio covering your old boss, Tiny Bradshaw's Train Kept a Rollin'.
Right.
So the music really, you know, went way beyond and continues to affect music today. What was Wynonie Harris like? Because his reputation was pretty wild.
He was like a, almost like a carbon copy of Sid Nathan. He was loud, and when he hit Brewster Avenue, you knew he was in town. You know, he was that loud kind of a caramel. He was just a good singer, though. But he and Sid, they had their problems. So when we knew that Wynonie was coming in, we knew there was going to be some problems because he and Sid always had words. But in the final analysis, we always got a good recording out of him because he was a great singer.
Still sounds great today, in
yeah.
fact.
I heard the news, there's blues rocking tonight. Gonna hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty man. I heard the news, there's blues rocking tonight. Have you heard the news? Everybody's gonna rock tonight. Gonna hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty man. Have you heard the news? They're good rocking tonight. So meet me in the alley behind the barn. Don't be afraid, I'll do you no harm. Baby, bring my rocking shoes, cause tonight I'm gonna rock away all my blues. Have you heard the news? They're good rocking tonight. Everybody's gonna rock tonight. I'm gonna hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm.
So was there a sense that this music was changing?
Oh, yes. I didn't realize it until, like I said earlier about Tiny Bradshaw hiring me, because he noticed that in my playing when he really saw me at the Savoy Ballroom. And that's what he wanted, a quieter drummer, but still powerful enough to drive a band.
And that's kind of the era covered by the Night Train to Nashville. It sort of shows that arc of the music of going from essentially that post-big band bluesier sound to that smoother, whether it's more pop-oriented or whether it's using that microphone for seduction. You know, it's a very different sound to the music.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Larry. Thank you. You know, at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, yeah, we mounted an exhibit called Night Train to Nashville, Music City Rhythm and Blues, and it really explored the years 1945 to 1970. And you know,
a lot of ground covered.
Yeah, we did this exhibit 10 years ago, and at the time, a lot of people were surprised that Nashville even had such a rich R&B scene. But, like, you know, to get to your point, the reason we started it in 1945 is because, you know, that's when Nashville's first real record label came on board, and that was Bullet Records. And they had people like Cecil Gant and B.B. King and even Wynonie Harris recorded for Bullet. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we started with the exhibit. But then, like you said, the sounds changed over the decades. And, like, one of the big hits that came out of Nashville was a singer by the name of Gene Allison, who had a song, You Can Make It If You Try, which was kind of that dawning of soul music. And, you know, in the 1950s, had that real churchy sound with the organ and all that.
And Phil, your music obviously was really a part of that evolution of the music in the 1950s as things changed.
Right.
So Little Willie John, I think, is one of those really undeservedly, he's pretty well forgotten nowadays, I think. You know, if people hear Fever, they hear Peggy Lee's version. And, you know, it's funny, if you listen to the Little Willie John version and then you listen to the Peggy Lee version, which we've all heard all our lives, if you play them back to back, the Peggy Lee version sounds so stiff and kind of, it's too fast. It's just not, it loses that groove. I guess she didn't have Philip Paul on the session, the only thing I could say.
Thank you.
But it's really a big difference between the two. And tellingly, when Elvis cut Fever, it was the Little Willie John version he went to. It wasn't the bigger hit at that point.
You never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that you give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't. Give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning and fever all through the night.
But while you were there too, the music was changing. You know, black music was changing from that kind of very bold, kind of brashy sound of Wynonie into the Little Willie John stuff, which would be soul music. It's a quieter. Oddly enough, your drumming is almost a metaphor for the way the music was changing, going from an Eagle Eye to a Philip Paul with the subtler brush work and dialing it back some, which works on recordings. And a very intimate singer, obviously, with Fever, great version of Fever, cut with Little Willie John there. But you remember when James Brown came to the studio for the first time. You were there, I believe.
Right. We were recording someone. I don't recall who it is, but James Brown was out in the hallway, and he had three flames with him. They were waiting to do a demo for Sid so they could get on the label. We stopped recording, and I forgot who James Brown's manager was at the time, but he told James, go ahead, you know. So they started singing this, please, please, please. And they got to a fever pitch where they were, three guys were laying on the floor, and they were saying, please, please, please. They were going at it. And Sid said, wait a minute, wait a minute. What is that? So the manager said, oh, that's that group, Mr. Nathan, that I brought in. I want you to hear them so we could record this tune for you. He said, what is that? I'm sorry, but I have to use some profanity here. Sid said, that's a piece of shit. But see how wrong he was, because they recorded Please, 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 and that changed. Here we go. It changed the music style again. We don't have to think about what happened with that tune and what happened with James Brown. Made him an international star.
Please, please, please.
That's true. And of course, Sid was notoriously wrong. He also was against James Brown doing the record at the Apollo in Harlem.
Right.
That was, he didn't want to see him do a live record, et cetera, and that became a massive hit. I guess Henry butted heads a lot with Sid over music. And John, did Henry talk about Sid Nathan, where they disagreed on different musical things? Were there different ideas?
Well, Henry just said that Sid really didn't have any musical knowledge, and so he pretty much had to try to keep Sid out of the studio. He wasn't always successful, but he did mention something that you said earlier about psyching people out. Louis Innes was there in the capacity of...
And he was the bass player in the band, was that?
Well, I think Louis played guitar.
Played rhythm guitar then in those sessions.
But he was working in the capacity of a producer, selecting material. So Sid had psyched out this man, and poor Louis just was so nervous, he had no self-confidence anymore. So to show him that Sid didn't know what he was talking about and loosen him up, what they did was to take an Elvis Presley hit and put it on acetate and put that in a number of acetates that Sid was supposed to listen to. And they get to that song. Like you said, Sid used some profanity. Well, what the hell is that? You know what? One by one, all the people in the A&R meeting suppressing laughter just left. So Henry told Louis, see that? Sid doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't even recognize Elvis Presley. So after that, Louis did a lot better.
Now, Sid did respect the idea that some people did know music. And in fact, he hooked you, Phil, up with the drummer from the symphony for drum lessons. But
right.
It actually, what happened with that?
Well, I got Ed Weibel. I think Mr. Weibel is still alive. But Sid asked me, he said, I want you to go to the conservatory. So I said, sure, fine. I said, are you going to pay for it? Yeah. He said, yeah, I'll pay for it. He was very nice that day. I should have known something was up, but I said, thank you. And I went over and I started studying with Ed Weibel. I learned quite a bit. I'm not going to say I didn't learn anything, but I was still playing clubs at night, even though I was recording a lot. That was when the Bossa Nova came out. And Mr. Weibel would ask me to play the Bossa Nova because evidently he heard something that he liked and something that he could use. So we taught each other to a certain degree. But I'd like to mention one thing about going back to Sid, like, threatening the A&R man. He had an A&R man by the name of Gene Red, who was Tiny Bradshaw's son-in-law. And Gene Red was a very educated musician. He played vibes, he played saxophone, he played trumpet. And he also wrote Please Come Home for Christmas for Charles Brown. And we made that album, a whole album of Christmas tunes, which became a hit. Everybody made money except the musicians, especially the A&R man. And A&R men like Sonny Thompson and Gene Red, like I mentioned. And they bought Cadillacs. So I just want to show you how the fear that Sid Nathan would put in people. And they would never park in the vicinity of King Records. They'd park maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 blocks, maybe sometime a mile away, because they didn't want Sid to know that they had bought a Cadillac with some of the money they made for this recording. So it's strange. It's strange the power that Sid had over people, you know. And they weren't like me. I knew Sid was a blowhard. I knew that he would raise a lot of hell, but he and I talked a lot about personal things and family, and I had no fear of Sid Nathan at all. Believe me.
You know, you've said that, you know, in the past as well. I think that's very unusual for people to hear that, because Sid's reputation was unanimously bad in the business. I think it's why it took him so long to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, to get the notice that he finally did get, because I mean, he was a real pioneer. He wasn't doing it as a creative musician. He was doing it, you know, strictly for the money, but he did it very successfully and created a massive amount of great music, at least 350 songs of which features Philip Paul on the drums. So an impressive feat across the board. One thing I love is the story you tell about how you developed the technique of playing with the country musicians, because there is no such thing as country drums. I mean, when you started to play, so you basically had to invent that. What did you hear, and how did you develop your rhythms?
Well, I think it was either Cowboy Copas or one of those gentlemen that came in, and this was a live recording.
And by that, you mean everybody in the studio playing at once. It wasn't an audience or anything.
That's right. They would look at me and they said, well, boy, he said, what you going to play? So I looked at him. I said, well, boy, what you going to play? Let me hear what you going to play. So they would start playing, and I would listen to nuances of the tune, and I would decide. Sometimes I'd play with brushes alone, and one of the recordings, I decided to pick up a stick and a brush. And the way the tune sounded, it sounded as if this would fit. And it did. And it became a hit record. And I had to use that connection on a lot of country tunes, just a stick and a brush. I played the stick with the left hand, and sometimes I played a rim shot, or sometimes I just played the top of the head, and I'd swish the brush with my right hand. And they love that sound, and that's my sound. I came up with that.
Well, I'll tell you, to me, that's one of the most brilliant innovations, I think, that we could see from you, because as somebody who plays bluegrass and country-type guitar, I think anybody in the audience who does, you know that they call it the boom chang, which is you hit a bass note and then you hit a strum. Correlation to the drums with that sharp stick sound and then the long brush stroke is exactly that translated to the drums. So, I mean, that's a brilliant analogy, musical analogy.
Yeah, you could hear that in the music. And
yeah,
it worked.
That's very fitting. John?
Well, there was a bass player named Ernie Newton. I don't know if you ever encountered him, but he was famous for putting a drum head on the side of his bass.
Lightning Chance did that too, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Lightning Chance did it. But he held a brush in his right hand, and he would pluck the string and then on the offbeat hit the drum head with the brush, so you had that boom. That's even on some Bill Monroe records.
And that was a way of rather than emulating another sound for the drums, that was a way of smuggling the drums into the music.
A one-man band, huh?
That's kind of it. And then back then, you would slap the bass. There was a lot of ways of getting percussion onto an upright string bass. But the drum head is, and you'll still see some around Nashville, some bass players are using that innovation. So how were you treated by the, you know, you mentioned that they might call you boy on the sessions. Yeah. If you were crossing a color line, you know, you're the Jackie Robinson of King Records.
Right.
You know, so I think that what you're doing in the studio, what were the reactions with the country musicians?
Well, in the beginning, they were kind of checking me out. I knew that. So I treated them with respect, so long as they respected me, and we got along. After the recording was over, it was great. We were great friends then. We didn't know what to do with each other. We didn't know what to play with each other, but we worked it out, and we became great friends and made some great music.
Well, you know, so often you find, like, if you talk to the musicians that recorded at Stax in Memphis, it's music itself, and the studio is almost like a demilitarized zone. It's a green zone out of the segregation and just the you know, the crap you see out in the social world out there. King itself, though, was a completely fully integrated business where the production, the shipping, there were blacks and whites and Asians and all sorts of different nationalities working together at King.
You were basically there to make a good product and show the world your talent. So in the end, that's what it was all about. So, you know, you have to put all that aside. That's what we should do now. Put all of those other ideas aside and get down to work and do a good job. That's what we were doing.
We can learn from King, I think. But it would be sometimes a shock to be in the studio all day with that kind of easy relationship across the races and then go out into the real world, go out to a diner or whatever. You mentioned Jimmy McGarry. You went out with him.
In fact, it was a diner right across the street on McMillan in Cincinnati here. And we were playing a club called Mother's, and we had a break and we decided to go over there and get some coffee, and we walked in, and the guy stopped me at the door and said, "We don't serve you." He told Jimmy, "You can go in." And cops. We don't serve. He used the word, and I turned around and walked away. So by that time, you know, I had gotten used to the word, so it really didn't bother me. It's just where we were at that time, just a bad time.
But as a New Yorker, which, you know, is, you know, you can say whether they hide it or whatever, but New York is a very different racial climate. You came down to Cincinnati, which was a very different place from what you were used to. Was that a culture shock for you as far as the racial?
Well, you know, when I came down to Cincinnati to join Tiny Bradshaw, we went on a road and we played the, as they call it, the
Chitlin' Circuit.
And it was nothing but prejudice. We played all the southern states, and we couldn't go in the whole same hotels. We couldn't get anything to eat on. I remember I was married at the time to my wife, and we used her as a ploy to get some food on a holiday night because they wouldn't serve us in a restaurant in Alabama. So we sent my wife into the restaurant. They served her. She told them that she had five musicians out here, and it was Thanksgiving evening, and that we haven't had anything to eat. They sold it to her and treated her very nice, but it was different with the men. They didn't want to serve the guys. So we confronted that in most of the southern states. So by the time I got to Cincinnati and, you know, this guy, the diner, didn't want to wait on me, well, that's something I was used to. We knew of it. We knew it was happening. So
in that sense, it's easier to be in the studio than to be on the road.
Yeah, it's better to be complied and be shot at, too, because I've had a gun put in my face, and I told to walk, and I did that. So that was minor what happened in Cincinnati at that time.
Well, it's an amazing life, Phil. I think the music you've made, and you continued working in the 60s. You worked with Roy Merriweather, that trio. You were on Columbia Records, right, with Roy?
Right. That was a different situation altogether. That was easy recording with Roy. We did a live recording, and which was great. And we did recording in a small studio, small room, and which was great. But I think my greatest enjoyment was really working with King Records. I loved working with Sid Nathan. I did. I'm one of the few musicians who will say that, too.
And he paid you.
Right.
You got what he promised. That's
right.
A part of it.
Had everybody say that.
I'm one of the few musicians that can say that, because we got along great. We got along very well.
I was going to say, Mr. Paul, this is Michael Gray, and man, this has been such a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, you know, I love this period of music and the records you played on, and I've just really enjoyed this, and it's been an honor. Other than collecting the paycheck, did you actually enjoy the country records that you played on? Did you like the music?
Oh, yeah. I'm a little different than the average musician, because I know a lot of musicians. They're jazz musicians, and that's what they play. They don't play anything else. Me, I will play any kind of music. I said if it swings, I'll play it. You know, if good musicians, I'll play any kind of music. All music is good if it's played well. I think that's the freedom I have with getting along with everyone. I'd rather play jazz, but I mean, you know, this is a living here. You do this for a living. It's not by choice. Sometime you have to play what everyone wants.
And you can still be heard in Cincinnati at the Cincinnatian Hotel, right? You're
right.
Still gigging.
Every weekend. Gigging.
All right. From 6 to 11.
Right.
plug the gig.
I'm heading that way.
And you get a lot of people from all over the world coming in to speak to you about those old records.
Thanks to the internet, we get people that coming in from all over the world, and they come right to the hotel to hear our group.
What's your favorite memory of King? What's the thing that really, when you think back to King, is there one thing that really stands out in your mind?
I think it's the Freddie King recordings. He was just a great guy to record with. He knew what he wanted, and he played well. He's one of the greatest guitar players I ever played with. We had no problems. We could go in and do a session in an hour with Freddie King. And Little Willie John was great. I liked Charles Brown, too. Those three people were real professionals, and I always enjoyed those sessions.
But I think one important thing about the way you play and the variety, the depth of your musicianship, is that you also played with the Stanley Brothers. In the blues side, you've made some great recordings with Smokey Smothers, who's almost a country bluesman. right. there. So what was your approach to record? And I remember you talking about how you enjoyed those sessions. Tell us about recording with Smokey.
Well, you know, this is my philosophy. I listen to what a musician is doing, and I try to compliment that. And then after I compliment that, I try to make it better. And I do that with everybody I record with. And as a result, whoever's the leader really doesn't have anything to say because I'm doing what he wants. And it always works out smoothly, and we have no problems whatsoever. I listen to what the leader of the group or the lead musician is doing, and I compliment that. That's the secret to my playing.
It seems to be working for you. I wouldn't change it now if I were you, I think. It's going pretty good. So, I mean, you've been a professional musician at this point for 70 years.
Right.
A little more than that. That's an amazing life. You know, you talk about what the secret of life is. I think that, you know, listening to you speak and talk about listening to other people, what can you add to it? But, I mean, you know, you said it much better. I think there's a way of remaining aware and attentive and there. I mean, they talk about being in the moment. I think you are very much in the moment in your music.
Thank you.
I mean, the variety is crazy. If you look at the stuff you played on, it's just, it is from the most down-home country and the down-home bluegrass, down-home blues, into very sophisticated jazz settings and pop settings. So, John Rumblin?
No, I just want to thank you, sir, for the privilege of speaking with you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to an interview taped last month featuring Larry Nager, John Rumble, and Michael Gray in conversation with King Records session drummer Philip Paul. You'll find a playlist of tonight's music, plus more information about the King Records celebration in Cincinnati this month at WBXU.org. I'd like to thank Stuart Holman and Rick Andrus with their help on this special. I'm Lee Hay, and you've been listening to The Blues on 91.7 WBXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.